The Patriots are in a three-way tie for first place in the AFC East. And that's not the strangest thing about the NFL right now. And the future of the Red Sox is a green monster-sized question mark. It's Monday, October 9th, 2017. I'm Chris Gasper, and this is Season Ticket. Welcome to Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. First up, there's a lot to talk about in the NFL, and we're joined by a man who follows it all, Ben Volin, senior NFL writer for the Boston Globe. Ben, how you doing?
Doing well, Chris. Doing a little bit better than J.J. Watt and the Houston Texans this morning.
Absolutely. I hope you enjoyed a Sunday where the Patriots weren't playing. Even though they weren't in action, though, there was a lot going on around the NFL. And once again, the anthem was a focal point of professional football. You had Vice President Mike Pence attending a game for the Indianapolis Colts in Indianapolis. He is the former governor of the state of Indiana. You had them playing the San Francisco 49ers, Colin Kaepernick's former team. And predictably, there were 49ers players who decided to kneel for the anthem. They actually did it with their hands on their hearts. However, that wasn't enough for Vice President Pence. He got up and left, saying that those players had disrespected the flag. He had a tweet. He said, "I left today's Colts game because at POTUS and I will not dignify any event that disrespects our soldiers, our flag, or our national anthem." What's your take on this?
I have many takes on this. The first being that statement from Pence rings so hollow because unless you've been sticking your head in the sand for the last year and a half, you know the 49ers are going to kneel. They're the kneeling team.
Absolutely.
They started it and they've had anywhere from 10 to 20 players often weekly kneeling. And so you had to understand and expect that the 49ers were going to do this. So if you didn't want to dignify this event, why show up in the first place unless you were just, you know, living under a rock somewhere? So, you know, just a total publicity stunt from the administration, obviously, and wasting, I saw, according to CNN, it cost them about $250,000 for them to pull this off with the flights and the extra security and things of that nature. And what's more fascinating to me is this kneeling issue had almost gone away, and the administration pours gasoline on the fire to reignite it. So for all the people who just want us to stick to sports, your president and your vice president are the people who are bringing politics back into sports.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, this is something that I think President Trump and Vice President Pence feel like resonates with their base. And this is something where they're sort of a little bit in a culture war, I think, with the NFL. And they feel like they're winning. And I don't blame them for feeling that way, because you have an owner in Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys, who's one of the seven owners, who contributed to President Trump's inaugural fund. And he came out and said that any player of his who does not stand for the anthem won't be allowed to play, which is basically what Trump said NFL owners should do a couple of weeks ago at that now infamous campaign rally for an Alabama senatorial candidate in Huntsville, Alabama, when he came out and called those guys sons of female dogs. So when you look at it, it seems like they're winning because they've hit the owners where it hurts, which is their egos and their wallets. They're basically trying to paint the NFL as an un-American league and take their customers away. And I think some of these owners are concerned that it's working.
Absolutely. And I think that's why you've seen the last 2 weeks, there have been meetings at the NFL headquarters in New York between owners and some players. And again, they like to couch it as having a good dialogue and a discussion. And we want to express a theme of unity. But it's basically about telling the players, we don't want you guys kneeling because it could affect our bottom line and it could affect some of our sponsors. So far, it hasn't. But Jerry Jones's comments that any player who kneels is not going to play for him, that's a hard right turn from where the NFL, what they had been saying about how they support their players' right to free speech and this and that. And Jerry Jones's words sound tough, but I would love to know what would happen if Dak Prescott or Jason Witten or Ezekiel Elliott took a knee. Then we'll see if he really is a man of his convictions.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I think that's an interesting point, Ben, because if you have Ezekiel Elliott or Dak Prescott, the quarterback of the Cowboys is Prescott, star running back Ezekiel Elliott. If either one of those two guys took a knee and then they said, well, you can't play, I think you might have a player revolt on your hands, because now you're hitting them where it hurts, which is their opportunity to win. These are protests that are peaceful and take place before the actual games. But if now you're going to do something to make it affect the player's ability to win, which right now it does not, I would be really interested to see what would happen there. I also tend to agree with you. I think this was Pence doing this. It was a premeditated political stunt. It's something that looks good for Pence and Trump and their base. And I think the unfortunate part of it in the statement that Pence made and the statement or the tweet, I should say, from President Trump is, look, they have a right to feel the way they feel, the same way the players have a right to feel the way they feel. But when you have the president and vice president of the United States not even addressing the issue that the players are kneeling over, I think once the issue gets addressed, I think that's how you'll end up ending the anthem kneeling. I think it keeps being perpetuated because everyone who wants to say it's not the right thing to do uses the platform and the approach to completely cover up the issue, which is social injustice and inequality in policing, and not even a mention of that from Vice President Pence or President Trump. I think that's really unfair, and I think it's really dangerous. All right, so now we will go to what happened on the field in the NFL on Sunday. And I thought the Patriots were big winners, even though they didn't even play, Ben. When you looked around the rest of the AFC, certainly the Kansas City Chiefs won, so they're 5-0. That was a big win over the Houston Texans. But when you looked at the way other teams played, and also huge losses, the Texans losing J.J. Watt, which you alluded to earlier, to a broken leg. Break it down a little bit for me. What did you see from the rest of the AFC on this Sunday where the Patriots were idle?
Yeah, definitely a lot of mediocrity. Talking about the AFC, there's definitely the wheat is separating from the chaff, and right now you have the Chiefs and probably the Patriots and maybe the Denver Broncos who were off yesterday. They're 3-1. But to your point that the Patriots were winners, see, the way I look at it, if I'm a Patriots fan, I'm a little nervous now because now the Chiefs have two games on you and a head-to-head win. So, sure, Pittsburgh getting blown out by Jacksonville was shocking. Ben Roethlisberger, you know, wheezing his way to the finish there, throwing five picks. That was a shocking result. And, you know, the Ravens are hit and miss. They get blown out a couple weeks ago. But right now, if I'm a Patriots fan, I'm worried about the Kansas City Chiefs and that hot start that they're off to.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, certainly they're 5-0. I guess the way I look at it, if you're the Patriots, though, you look at your division. The Bills, I don't believe in a Tyrod Taylor quarterback team. The Jets obviously have won 3 in a row, but they just beat the Browns on Sunday. And I don't believe in a Josh McCown quarterback team. And the Patriots will play the Jets at MetLife Stadium on Sunday for first place in the AFC East. I can't believe I just said that.
That's amazing.
That is incredible. And Miami, to me, even though they won, they still can't find their offense. You're right about the Chiefs. The thing I'd say, though, is the Chiefs are in a much tougher division. So certainly Kansas City has a good head start, but I think they have a much tougher road the rest of the way, at least in the division, than the Patriots do. And I think the Patriots are in a good position here, but at least to get a bye in the first round here, because these other teams are not separating.
But, you know, the Patriots still have a tough road ahead. They have that stretch in November and December where they have 5 out of 6 on the road. They got the Falcons coming to town in a couple weeks. Anyone here think that they can stop the Falcons?
We'll see. That will be the test for the defense.
You know, so, you know, they still have to play at Mexico City against the Raiders, at Denver. They still have all their division games ahead of them. Even this game against the Jets, not going to be easy. I still think they win, of course, because I don't believe in the Jets' offense. But going into the Meadowlands against the Jets, very good defense. Tom Brady, you know, better get healed up this week because he's going to get battered and bruised a little bit. I just think the margin for error now for the Patriots is razor thin with those two losses in Kansas City already being 5-0.
Yeah, there's a lot of teams, the Patriots included, who I think are works in progress at this point of the season. There's no question about that. I just have a lot of faith in them being able to put it together. I think some of these other teams have had a chance to maybe jump on the Patriots here, and they haven't been able to do it. I did want to ask you about this. You know, injuries play such a big part in any team season. We've seen it with the Patriots losing Julian Edelman and Rob Gronkowski not playing on Thursday night. No J.J. Watt, no Whitney Mercilus moving forward for Houston. And then in the NFC, how much worse can it get for the New York Giants? They lose Odell Beckham Jr. and they're 0-5 on the season, one of three 0-5 teams in the NFL.
Yeah, tough day for the NFL, losing two marquee players for the season in J.J. Watt and Odell Beckham. You don't see that in any other sport. Like, can you imagine the NBA, like LeBron James and Steph Curry both suffer a season-ending injury on the same day? So really unfortunate. But, you know, seeing how the Giants season has unfolded and you know, watching what happened in Pittsburgh yesterday, Roethlisberger throwing two pick sixes, it just makes you appreciate what the Patriots have accomplished. They never get blown out. They never start a season 0-5. You look at the Giants on paper, they look great. I had them winning the NFC East this year. They had a great defense last year. They added Brandon Marshall, Odell Beckham. I mean, and they're 0-5. And that has never happened to the Patriots. We're ready to, you know, run for the hills here in New England, and they're 3-2. So to me, it just goes to show how remarkable it is what they've accomplished under Belichick and Brady.
All right, Ben, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it very much. Great NFL talk. We'll talk to you very soon, I'm sure.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
Coming up, what are the Red Sox prospects for the future? Everyone has an opinion. We'll sort through it all. That's next. We're back here on Season Ticket. The Red Sox were down 2-0 in their 5-game series against the Houston Astros, but the Red Sox had a revival on Sunday thanks to some great hitting.
One out, two on, and the 2-2 from Musgrove to Jackie Bradley Jr. Swung on and hit in the air, deep right field toward the corner. Reddick over near the wall, reaching for it. Oh. It's off his glove and into the stands. A home run for Jackie Bradley Jr. A 3-run homer for JBJ. And the Red Sox lead it 10-3.
And a remarkable bit of pitching from David Price, the former starter who is now a star reliever.
Price set at the belt, looks at first. Now the kick and the pitch. Swung on a miss, strike three, he got him. Four scoreless innings for David Price. Gonzalez looked like he took
a... The Globe's Alex Speer writes about the Red Sox. He joins us now via Skype. I think the big story out of Game 3 certainly was David Price and him riding to the rescue for four scoreless innings in this game. Do you think he was able to change the narrative of his season and the way people feel about his Red Sox career with the way he's pitched in this series and particularly in that third game?
Well, I think that it forces anyone to take a step back. For anyone who is just kind of purely critical of what he's done in the postseason, that was as high a leverage performance as one can ever see. Every pitch that he threw was with the Red Sox ahead by one run, and this was against a historically good Houston offense, one of the best fastball hitting teams of all time, a team that was the highest scoring team in the big leagues since, I believe, 2009. The fact that he was that on point, that he executed with that kind of precision, with those kinds of stakes, to me, I think that's a pretty compelling image and one that has to factor into anyone who's ever said, oh, David Price is soft.
When you look at it, David Price now going back to the regular season, since they made this decision to use him as a sort of super relief pitcher, he's made 7 relief appearances. He has yet to allow a run, over 15 in the third innings pitch. He struck out 19. He's walked just 4. He also pitched in game 2 of this series, so he threw 2 times in 3 days, and he threw a total of 95 pitches. That leads me to think he might have been able to start in this series, and would the Red Sox have been better off using him as a starter, and is that something they can do moving forward in the postseason?
So there's a lot that's interesting there to unpack. First of all, could they have built him up as a starter? Well, the fact that he was throwing 57 pitches on, what, one day of rest suggests, yes, they could have built him up as a starter. However, there is a question of whether or not in the postseason that is more valuable than the guy who can come in and do what he's done so far and what the Red Sox hope that he can do going forward. So he was able to kind of stabilize game 2 for a while and give the Red Sox at least a chance to come back into the game. In game 3, he was the reason why they won. In 2 consecutive games, he had a pivotal role. David Price has thrown more innings in this series than anyone else on the Red Sox. He's thrown more innings than any of their starters. In fact, he's thrown as many innings as any of their other 2 starters combined this series. So when you think about the value of the role as opposed to the role that he could have performed, I'm not sure if you would be able to get a higher leverage role than the one that he's performed in.
Yeah, that's a good point. The only thing I would say when you look at it is that if he had started, that wouldn't have necessarily precluded him from coming back in some sort of bullpen role later in the series. Certainly not like this. I agree with you. But the reality is he's had to come into games where the team has already been in a position where they're down. If he were starting a game, and look, trust me, I know. I'm more than well aware of his playoff record as a starter, 0-8. We all know that. But when you look at how abysmal their starting pitching has been in this series, you're sort of putting yourself behind the eight ball every game. And luckily you've had David Price to stabilize things, but wouldn't it be nice to get a strong performance to start?
Unquestionably, they need to figure out something better than what they've had thus far in the postseason in the first inning. So through 3 games, the Red Sox have a 15.12 rotation ERA.
That is
the worst all time for any team in any postseason from a rotation. So that gives you some indication of the performance level. I think that's like 415 teams in that sample. So in short, yes, the Red Sox need better from their starting rotation. So let's say you would use Price in game 2, then he wouldn't have been available in game 3. You're maximizing the number of games that he's able to influence. It's pretty interesting to try to figure out where you're maximizing the value of a pitcher in the postseason.
I want to talk to you about something that I think you wrote about before this series, and I thought was huge in game 3, outfield defense. Mookie Betts had the catch. He saved a 3-run homer off the bat of former Red Sox Josh Reddick in the second inning. That would have put the Red Sox in a 6-0 hole. A great catch.
3-2 pitch. Swinging a drive to right field. This is deep. Mookie going back to the warning track. Turns by the fence and makes a basket catch. It would have been a home run. It would have been gone by the low wall in right field. Mookie Betts reached out and grabbed it.
And then you look at Houston's outfielders. You know, in that third inning, I thought George Springer maybe could have gotten to the double for Mitch Moreland. And then the ball that Hanley Ramirez hit to left field went off the glove of Marwin Gonzalez. Then later in the game, the big three-run homer in the seventh from Jackie Bradley Jr. goes off the glove of Reddick and into the stands. The Red Sox clearly have an advantage here in outfield defense, and I felt like yesterday was the first time we saw that. The Astros are a little bit of a suspect defensive team.
I actually think that their outfield is fine. You know, it's more or less like a big league average outfield. Springer and Reddick tends to be really good. You've seen the impact that his throwing arm can make already in the series. And Springer covers a solid amount of ground. He's not Jackie Bradley Jr. though. And he's not Mookie Betts, and Josh Reddick isn't Mookie Betts. I mean, it is such an impactful thing to have guys who are able to chase down fly balls, especially in the postseason, especially in an era when everyone is trying to hit the ball in the air. You're basically kind of your pitching staff, especially with the Red Sox staff, that works a lot at the top of the strike zone and thus gets a lot of fly balls. You have a very significant opportunity to have the game pivot on just the ability to track down fly balls from, let's say, left center all the way to the right field foul line. We have seen it in action. We certainly saw it in action over the course of game three.
Yeah, I mean, if Mookie Betts doesn't make that play and they're down 6-0, I have a hard time envisioning them coming back. And conversely, if Springer or Marwin Gonzalez, if they're able to make those plays, there were two outs. Rafael Devers never comes to the plate, never hits that home run, and gives the Red Sox the lead and the momentum. The Red Sox do have some momentum, obviously, after game three. But ultimately, this series, I think a lot of people feel like, Alex, they need to get out of the first round here to sort of validate their season. If they do not get out of the first round, do you think John Farrell's job is in jeopardy? Or do you think the Red Sox look at the fact he's won back-to-back American League East titles? He's won three American League East titles as Red Sox manager, the only Red Sox manager to do that. Does Farrell have to win this series to keep his job?
Two separate questions. The first one is, or two separate issues at least, packed in there. The first one is whether or not they need to win the ALDS in order to validate their season. To that, I would say no, because the Astros are a better team. The Astros are the team that won 101 games with a lineup that's more loaded and with the better rotation right now. I think it would be an impressive upset if they were to advance. But is John Farrell's job in jeopardy if they don't advance out of the ALDS? In short, I think that a lot of people are kind of ready to say, oh, John Farrell's job is in jeopardy, where the reality is Dave Dombrowski has not said one thing on the subject, and save for his allusion on this very podcast to his saying, well, I think an extension would be a wintertime conversation. The idea that there would be a wintertime conversation did not suggest an imminence of danger for John Farrell's job, but I'm just a little bit leery of forecasting whether or not it's likely that he could be on thin ice.
Well, I certainly hope, Alex, that ownership has as much in-depth analysis and is as level-headed as you are when it comes to evaluating this situation. Thank you for bringing that to the podcast today.
I really appreciate that, Chris, but I think you're exaggerating what I'm bringing to it.
No, it was great. It was a great degree of equanimity to the podcast brought by Alex Speer. Thank you for joining us, Alex.
I'll put that on my epitaph. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. All right, that was Alex Speer, Boston Globe baseball writer, who just joined us here, and he broke it down for us. That was great. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks.
Finally, a segment we call the cheap seats. Well, it seems that a lot of baseball managers this postseason have forgotten that their starters are the better pitchers than the relievers. It seems more and more managers want to go into their bullpen earlier and earlier. In fact, Masahiro Tanaka, starting pitcher for the New York Yankees, became the first American League starter to complete 7 innings in this postseason on Sunday. Now, this is something that has become in vogue because of the way Andrew Miller was used by the Cleveland Indians last year. And obviously, David Price has worked out well for the Red Sox in that super reliever role. However, there are times that managers are going to the bullpen too early and it's actually hurting them. Just ask Yankees manager Joe Girardi, who took out a cruising CC Sabathia in game 2 after just 77 pitches, only to watch his bullpen give away the game. I think it would be nice if some of these managers let their starting pitchers finish what they started. That's it for this edition of Season Ticket. Listen, we want to thank you guys for an amazingly successful first week, and we know you'll stick around. If you liked us, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. To find out more about the podcast, go to wbur.org/seasonticket. For more great sports stories, subscribe to the Boston Globe. Season Ticket is a production of WBUR Radio and the Boston Globe. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Gasper. We'll see you tomorrow.